Okay, good morning, everybody. Good morning. Let's see if this microphone works. Test, test, test. Oh, that's good. It's coming on. Very good. You can hear me? Okay. And too loud. What's happening next time? Yeah, you have a test on Monday. Okay. And the test is all of the bones through joints, but nothing about muscle. All right, so what we covered last time or what we're covering today is not on the test. Just bones and joints will be on a test on Monday. So bring a good Scantron, a really good eraser, pencil, that kind of stuff. You don't need a calculator or anything like that. Okay, then here is the sign-in sheet for today. You can pass that around. And any questions about the test on Monday? Anything, any questions for the test on Monday? You're good? Excellent. All right, so we're going to actually move on and talk about, instead of microscopic structure of muscles, some of the more gross anatomical features of muscles, all right, and how we classify them. So here's some really good, just basic information that will just help you or will alleviate the necessity of memorizing every single muscle in the body, because you'll be able to recognize them by their shape or other kinds of attributes, and it will be easy to know the actions of certain muscles and the names of certain muscles with this general information. Okay, so the first thing we're going to talk about here is the arrangement of fascicles in muscles. And what the heck is a fascicle? If you got a muscle organ, you can break it down into compartments within the muscle that we call fascicles. And there's connective tissue that separate the fascicles out. So you can actually see with your naked eye the fascicles and what kind of arrangement they have. All right, so some muscles are circular. And a circular muscle we're always going to call an orbicularis. And of course, since this is skeletal muscle, that's got to be voluntary muscle. All right, so can anybody give me an example of a circular muscle? Those of you that have been in that lab already would know. For instance, around your eye, that's an orbicularis oculi. Around your mouth is an orbicularis oris muscle. And what do those look like? Here's a good example. So here's a circular skeletal muscle like the orbicularis oris muscle. All right, but anytime you see the circular muscle, you're going to call it what? Orbicularis oris, or orbicularis, right? Okay. Other kinds of muscles will have parallel arrangement of fascicles, not circular, long fiber shortened the most, but not very powerfully. So there's a lot of range of motion, but it's not a very powerful kind of muscle. There's a very strap-like muscle called the sternocleidomastoid, and we can see sternocleidomastoid, not on this slide at all, all right? But in the neck, right? They're going to be like a rubber band muscle in the neck. Here is another one, the sartorius, which is in the leg, right? And if you look at all the fascicles, you're going to see that they all line up parallel to each other. Another kind that is a parallel is what we call fusiform. It's kind of tapered at both ends. And what I mean by that is that think of like the shape of a fish, or even more importantly, a better example would be a porpoise. What is the size of the nose of a porpoise compared to where its dorsal fin is? Its nose is what? Really narrow, so it allows it to swim through water very, very easily. We have some muscles in our body that are shaped like that, not because they like to swim through water, but because that's just their particular shape. I was using the example of a dolphin as an example, but a good example in your body would be the biceps brachii. Notice how the ends kind of come together, it pinches together at the origin, and it kind of pinches together again at the insertion of the biceps muscle. Maybe I'll turn the light down so you can see a little bit easier. Is that better? Is that better? How about that? Better yet? Okay, let's leave it like that. So fusiform, so the fascicles kind of converge, right, at the ends of the muscle. Okay. Here's one where the fascicles definitely converge to a point. right? And that's the pectoralis major muscle. So here's the pectoralis major. And if we isolate this one, right? So the origin is very broad origin. And all of these fascicles point right into the insertion, right, on the humerus right here. So this is what we call a convergent fascicle arrangement. Pectoralis is a really good example of that. And then we have pennate, a couple examples of pennate. And a pennate is supposed to remind you of a flag or a pennant, right? And a flag is always kind of flown off of a flagpole, which is what, really long, right? So unipennate, for instance, like a flexor pollicis longus would be a unipennate muscle. So here is like the flagpole. This is just a common tendon, right? And all these fascicles then attach to that tendon, almost at right angles to it. So this would be a unipennate muscle. And then here would be a bipennate. So just instead of just having muscle on one side of the tendon, you have muscle on both sides. For instance, like the rectus femoris that you have in your thigh. And then we can even have multipennate muscle arrangements. For instance, in the deltoid, it has a number of major muscle groups, and on each one of these groups right here, you have a bipennate arrangement. So this is what we call multipennate. And you can activate each one of these different groups independently or all together. So if you activate primarily this anterior muscle of the deltoid, that's going to flex your humerus. If you activate primarily the posterior part, that's going to extend the humerus, right? And if you activate just this middle section or the middle section along with the posterior and anterior sections equally, then that's going to produce abduction, okay? So this muscle can have many different motions because of the pennate arrangement of this deltoid muscle. Okay, so this one in the deltoid, the fibers are really short, right? But since they're very, very short fibers right here, there's not a lot of contraction that they can perform, but they can contract very powerfully as a result of that. Okay, so there's a trade-off with the range of motion and the power that can be generated. All right, so that's muscles by fascicle arrangement. When we start to study muscles, something that will help us again remember muscles so we don't have to memorize quite so much. It's nice to understand the relationship that a muscle has with all the other muscles in the body or some other muscles in the body. So sometimes muscles will be synergistic if they work together to perform the same kind of motion. And a good way of thinking about this is if you have muscles in the same body compartment, all of those muscles will be producing about the same kind of motion. So if we look at the anterior arm, right, in the anterior arm, all of these muscles are going to cause flexion of the forearm or flexion at the wrist. And there are a couple important muscles there. One you're probably familiar with before you took an anatomy class, and that is the biceps brachii, which is very superficial. But there's even one that's more important that is underneath it, and that is the brachialis. All right, so both of those working together to cause flexion of the forearm, we call those synergist muscles. And if there are a group of muscles all performing the same kind of motion, there is one that usually does most of the work. And the one that does most of the work for forearm flexion is really not the biceps brachii, but is the brachialis, the muscle that's deep to the biceps brachii. And in lab, you definitely have to find out where that one is, okay, when you start to look at it. So I don't think I have a really good picture. Oh, yeah, you have a picture of it probably someplace, maybe right here. Okay, so anterior arm, you have the biceps, and then deep to the biceps right here is the brachialis muscle. Right, and you can even see it a little bit lateral right here, and that is actually the prime mover or the strongest muscle for flexing the forearm. All right, but here's the most important concept. This is really what gives you control over your body, and that is the arrangement of antagonistic muscles. All right, so if we said that synergistic muscles are in the same body compartment, like all the muscles in the anterior forearm are going to cause flexion of some part of your body, like a wrist or a digit, all right, the muscles that are antagonistic to each other will be in an opposite body compartment. And a really good example of this would be a muscle for flexing the forearm, which is the biceps brachii, and the antagonistic muscle is going to be in the posterior forearm, and that's the triceps brachii for extension. And because of the action of these two muscles, even though they work in opposition to each other, it provides for precise control and balance of your forearm. Right? Because antagonistic control is very, very important, just like in your car. Right? You'd never think of driving your car without two mechanisms that work against each other. And what are those two mechanisms? The gas and the brake pedal, right? Okay. Then there are some muscles that really don't produce a lot of motion. And we call these fixators. There are a number of muscles that attach to the scapula. The scapula has to be in a particular position in order for your humerus or the bone in your arm to work properly. All right, so the muscles that hold the scapula in position so that your arm can move properly are what we call fixators. And there are a number of different kinds of fixators, like the subscapularis, the levator scapulae, the rhomboids. And we'll mention some of these as we talk about muscles, right? So those are fixators. They don't really produce motion. They actually inhibit motion so that other muscles can do their job. All right, so how can we name muscles? Here's a good little cheat sheet for naming muscles. We can name muscles by all of these different attributes right here. So this is really handy. So sometimes we name a muscle by its location. That's particularly handy. Like the brachialis is going to be in the brachium. And where is the brachium? That's your arm. Okay. Intercostals. Inter means between, and a costal is a rib. So these are muscles between the ribs. And you can probably guess what their function is. Their function is for breathing. Okay, we'll talk about that. We can also talk about muscles by their shape. A really good one to recognize right away is one we looked at already. That's a deltoid. It's kind of triangular shape on your shoulder. And then we can talk about, or we can name a muscle by its relative size. Sometimes we might have a group of muscles that almost perform the same kind of motion. The motion might be a little bit different, but they're going to be in about the same part of the body, like the gluteus muscles. All right? And that's in your posterior, right? And the gluteus maximus is which one? The big one or the little one? That's the big one. And minimus is would be the small one, right? And then we have other muscles that we also name by calling it the longus and brevis. So there might be some muscles that have the exact same name in the same body compartment, but one is going to be longer than the other. So one's the longus and the other one is the brevis. And another good way to name muscles is by the direction of the fascicles. And you could probably give me an example. What's the name of a muscle where the direction of the fascicles tells us something important about that muscle? Like there are some that are circular. What would we call that muscle? Orbicularis. Okay, some have a straight arrangement of fascicles. That's what we would call a rectus. Like the rectus abdominis. So sometimes we even combine these terms, like a location term and a direction of fascicles term. Rectus abdominis tells us that's a very straight muscle in the abdominal area. All right, external oblique, right? External means not deep, it means a superficial muscle, and oblique means that it's going to be what? Angulated. It's not going to be on a transverse plane or coronal plane or frontal plane, it's going to be on an angulated plane. Okay. And then here is the nicest one. If you ever run into a muscle with this kind of nomenclature, this is the easiest to figure out. When a name includes the attachment points, what are the two attachment points of a muscle called? Origin and insertion, right? The insertion is the more movable end, origin is the more stationary end. So a good example of that would be the sternocleidomastoid. And when you first hear that name, you probably are thinking, well, that doesn't sound really easy at all. Sounds really complicated. But once you analyze that name, it becomes easy, right? When we name a muscle by origin and insertion, the origin always comes first, the insertion comes last. So sterno refers to the sternum, that's a part of the origin. Clido refers to the clavicle, that's also part of the origin, and then the insertion is mastoid. What region is that referring to? Mastoid process of the temporal bone. Okay, so that's really nice. And if you know the origin and insertion, then you can figure out the motion. Right, so if here is the origin on the sternum and clavicle and the insertion is the mastoid process, when that muscle contracts, that's going to flex the cervical spine. All right, so that's pretty easy to see. We also can name muscles by the number of origins that it has. Like the biceps has 2, triceps has 3, quadriceps has 4. All right, and we would combine quadriceps, for instance, with the location of that muscle, like the quadriceps femoris. Where's the femoral region? Can you remember where the femoral region is? That is your, yeah, that's your thigh associated with your femur. So these quadriceps muscles, or the quadriceps femoris, are going to be in your anterior thigh. And there's going to be a group of 4 muscles there all acting together. All right, now biceps, where do you have a biceps? Biceps brachii, right? So again, that's combining location with the number of origins, but you also have a biceps femoris. Where are you going to find that? In your thigh, but posterior thigh, right? So, and there's going to be 2 origins for that particular muscle. Okay. So would you consider the biceps brachii and the biceps femoris synergist muscles? Yes or no? The name sounds kind of like they got something in common, right? But it's just the origin. It's not the location of the body. Because the biceps brachii causes flexion of the elbow. The biceps femoris causes flexion of the leg, right? So a little bit different, all right? And then here's another really easy way to understand something about muscles. By their action, some muscles we name by calling them a flexor or extensor or adductor, abductor. And then if you know this action right here, you know what body compartment it's in, whether it's anterior, posterior, lateral, or medial, right? So for instance, a flexor muscle, if it is in your arm, all right, it's going to flex the forearm. Okay, and extensor is going to be on the opposite body compartment, the posterior arm. So when we look at the name of this muscle right here, extensor carpi radialis longus, right, that tells us a lot about this particular muscle. Like, generally speaking, when we see carpi right here, what part of your body is going to be moved by this muscle? The wrist, right, because the carpal bones are the wrist. And we have a couple of muscles that do that. One is going to be medial, one's going to be lateral. So the radialis is going to be the lateral muscle, right? And there's a group of them in that area, but this is going to be the longest one, right? And what body compartment is it in? Okay, if you say extensor, okay, all of these anterior muscles flex, so the extensor is going to be in the posterior forearm. All right, so when we think of extension and flexion, those are antagonistic motions, they're going to be in opposite parts of the body as a result. So that's a pretty handy way to name muscles. By their action, by their location, and by their size, you can combine all of those in that particular term. Okay, so this group of associations, maybe you should just memorize until it becomes second nature to you, all right? And maybe it is already ingrained. You can see how this works very nicely. Muscles in the anterior neck are going to cause flexion of the cervical spine, right? Flexion of the neck, all right? What about extension of the neck? Opposite body compartment, that's going to be in the posterior neck. All right. In terms of the rest of the vertebral column, the muscles that are in the anterior trunk, like abdominal muscles, the abdominis rectus, these are going to flex the vertebral column, right? Just like the anterior muscles in the neck flex the cervical spine. These will flex the vertebral column, and the extensors are going to be in the posterior trunk. The opposite body compartment produces the antagonistic motion. In the arm, you have anterior and posterior compartments. These are for moving the forearm. Forearm flexion will be in the anterior arm, forearm extension in the posterior arm, pretty much all those muscles there. And In the forearm, these muscles are going to work on digits, which are your fingers or your wrist. And so we would name them either carpi for the wrist or digitorum muscles that work on your digits. And they'll either be flexors or extensors depending on what body compartment they're in. So the anterior forearm are all going to be flexors. Posterior forearm, those are all going to be extensors. All right, so you don't have to memorize every particular muscle. Okay, in the lower appendage, right, we have anterior thigh, posterior thigh. Anterior thigh, we got the quadriceps for like kicking something that's extending the leg. And then for lifting your foot way up off the ground, right, that's your posterior thigh. We call that flexion of the leg or flexion at the knee. Like we just got done talking about the biceps femoris would be in that group. So the biceps femoris is antagonistic to what other muscle group? The biceps femoris is going to be antagonistic. Where do we find the biceps femoris at? Posterior thigh. So where are you going to start thinking about muscles? Where are you going to have to go to? What body part? Anterior thigh. And since you have to know something about the knee, you know a little bit about some muscles that are in that area, and that's the quadriceps. Right, so the biceps femoris and the quadriceps femoris are antagonistic to each other because they're on opposite sides of the thigh. All right, then, the other one that might be a little bit difficult to remember, only because you got to know the definition of dorsiflexion and plantar flexion. All right, these are both flexion kinds of motions, and it has to do working across the ankle. Dorsiflexion, who can tell me what dorsiflexion is all about? Lifting your toes up, yeah, lifting your toes up off the ground, very important when you're walking. All right, those are going to be in the anterior leg. There's a muscle that goes right by the tibia. We call that the anterior tibialis. So that's another nice little bit of nomenclature. So those are going to be dorsiflexors. But plantar flexors, those that point your toes into the ground, like when you're walking, all right, when you're pushing off, those are what we call plantar flexors. Those are going to be in the posterior leg. And some of the muscles back there that you're going to look at are the gastrocnemius and soleus. All right, so these antagonistic muscles still are in opposite body compartments. All right. So there are a number of origins and insertions that you have to know, and for sure, if I ever mention one in lecture or have it in my lecture notes, that's definitely one that you got to become really familiar with. Okay, like the occipital frontalis, sternocleidomastoid, rectus abdominis, biceps brachii, triceps brachii, gastrocnemius. All right, so make sure you know all the origins and insertions of these for lecture exam, not on Monday, but eventually when we have a lecture exam about muscles. Okay, let's look at some head muscles. So head muscles, a good exam figure for head muscles would be, okay, for instance, right here. These first two diagrams right here have pretty much every muscle that you're going to have to know by location. These are exam figures as well. All right, so this is really good practice for you, except I can't really expand it well enough with these projectors to use it in lecture. So we're going to go to some isolated parts of the body, for instance, like the head. Okay, and the occipital frontalis is kind of nice because we can go over nomenclature with this. And it's named after some bones in the body, right? Like the bone in this posterior part of the skull is the occipital bone. So this muscle right here is called the occipitalis. Sometimes it's called the occipital belly because it works with another muscle. Here's a common tendon that they both share that goes over the superior part of the cranium. And we call that the galea aponeurotica, and that is an aponeurosia, and an aponeurosia is a broad, flat, tendinous sheath around some part of your body. This particular one is right on the top of your head, and it connects the occipitalis with the frontalis right here. They work together, and when these muscles contract, and you could think of it as one muscle, if you think of it as one muscle, then you would call it the epicranius, or you could call it the occipitofrontalis, right? Because we can put different names together in anatomy as long as we do what with those two different names? Put an O between them, right? Occipitofrontalis. And when I say occipital frontalis, I'm using a special nomenclature to tell you what the origin and insertion is. What's the origin of the occipital frontalis? What comes first? Yeah, the origin comes first, which is occipitalis, so the origin is the occipital bone. When this muscle contracts, the occipital bone doesn't move, right, because most bones of your cranium don't move. And the insertion is over here on the frontalis. But the frontal bone isn't moving. In this particular example, this muscle doesn't attach on either end to bones. One end is the occipital bone. The other end actually inserts into some skin above the eyebrows. All right, so when this muscle contracts, your eyebrows are elevated. They move. So it's a muscle of facial expression. Okay, in most cases, when we look at muscles, both ends will be attached to bones, but not in this particular case. In other cases, when we talk about facial expression, it's going to be moving skin around. Okay. What's another one? Sternocleidomastoid. That's a good one to talk about because, again, we can use the origin and insertion is in part of that name. All right, so here's the sternocleidomastoid. It's just deep to the platysma, which has been taken off of this particular figure right here. So sternum and here's sternum and clavicle are the origins of this muscle. The insertion is the mastoid process. So when this muscle contracts, what bones move more, the clavicle and sternum or the temporal bone? The temporal bone, yeah, the mastoid process, and that's going to flex the cervical spine when that happens. All right, if both sternocleidomastoids, right, because it is bilateral, you have one on each side, if those muscles contract in unison, but if one contracts more than the other, it's going to produce a rotation to that side of what is ever contracting the strongest. All right, so sternocleidomastoid. Easy to remember the origin and insertions. And as a matter of fact, on the lecture test, I'm going to test your understanding of nomenclature, of naming muscles. I'll give you a name of a muscle that you haven't heard of before, and I'm going to ask the origin and insertion, or maybe just the origin, or maybe just the insertion. And then you could tell me, by looking at the name, what the origin and insertion is. Okay? Like, for instance, let's just pull one out that you're not exactly responsible for. All right? For instance, the thyrohyoid muscle. I could ask you, what's the insertion? The insertion of the thyrohyoid bone. Where's the insertion in the name of a muscle? The first part or last part? Last part. And what's the last part of thyrohyoid? Is the hyoid bone. Okay, so that would be the insertion. The origin, right here, thyro, you don't really know where that is yet, but it's a cartilage that makes up part of your larynx, the thyroid cartilage, that's actually your Adam's apple right here. All right, that would be the insertion. Oh, and as I'm talking, I can feel my thyroid cartilage bouncing up and down, moving around like crazy. All right, so there's a nice muscle for articulation. All right, so insertion, yeah, thyroid cartilage, so you don't know that yet, but I could ask you that because you should know where the hyoid bone is. That should ring a bell for you. Okay, and this is what we call the thyroid cartilage in the larynx, because really close to it is this thyroid gland right here. Okay, so that muscle has nothing to do with the gland, but this cartilage right here, the thyroid cartilage of the larynx. Okay, another muscle that's pretty important, trunk muscles. Let's look at the rectus abdominis muscle. So what do we know about the rectus abdominis? What region of the body is it in? Abdominal region. And rectus just means straight, parallel fascicle arrangements. And here is the rectus abdominis muscle right here. And almost the most superficial muscle in the abdominal region. And you can see a number of common insertions. Kind of reminds you of what? The epicranius or the occipital frontalis muscle. All right, but what? Three times over. You have this tendinous intersection between the different bellies of the rectus abdominis. And when this muscle contracts, well, let's talk about the attachment points. One attachment point is going to be on a little tiny bone up over here, which is the inferior part of the sternum. What do we call that small bone at the inferior edge of the sternum? Xiphoid process. So that's going to be one attachment point. The other attachment point is going to be the pubic bone, or the pubic bones of the azacaxae. All right, so which one of those bones moves more when the rectus abdominis contracts? Contract that rectus abdominis. What's happening? You can't watch me because I can't really do it anymore, but you guys can still do that. You're flexing your vertebral column, and it's the xiphoid process that gets bent down toward the pubis right there. Right? So the origin is the pubic bone, and the insertion is the xiphoid process. So that's kind of one thing that's, I think, handy for this part of the class, is that the other parts of the class, you really had to be in lab to look at the bones and become familiar with the bones, right? Maybe some bones you could realize pretty easily, like olecranon process, you know, the zygomatic bone on your face, nasal bone, things like that, frontal bone on your forehead. But the nice thing about muscles is that you don't always have to go to lab, because what do you have with you all the time? You got your muscles right with you, right? And you can practice exercising them and moving them to see how they move and what their connection points are. Okay. So in this particular case, the sternocleidomastoid and the rectus abdominis, the origin was inferior and the insertion was superior. That's kind of an anomaly. Most muscles, it's the other way around. All right, so let's see what our next muscle is right here. Biceps brachii. Okay, let's take a look at this one. And notice that I have an O, and then I got a double O right here. Guess what that means? It has two origins, yeah. All right, so let's see where these origins and insertion are for the biceps brachii. Here's a good example. Okay, so biceps brachii is the most superficial muscle in your anterior arm. There are two origins. One origin is on the coracoid process of the scapula, and the other is on a little nubbin right above the glenoid fossa. We call that the supraglenoid tubercle, right? That's why I thought it'd be a really good idea for you to know that one when we talked about bones, because the biceps is a really important muscle, and people have problems with their shoulder because the biceps does go across the shoulder joint. So it has two heads. The long head originates on that supraglenoid tubercle, and there's a very nice, strong, narrow tendon that goes right between the tubercles, the greater and lesser tubercle, near the head of the humerus, right? And there's a groove right there called the, I think that was on the practicum even, intertubercular groove, right? That's the long head. The short head just comes from the coracoid process and then immediately forms this muscle belly right here. And the biceps brachii is kind of interesting because not only does it go across the shoulder, but it goes across the elbow joint as well. So the biceps brachii can cause flexion at the shoulder, but it can also cause flexion at the elbow. It can do both of those, right? And probably for that reason, I don't really consider that the prime mover for elbow flexion or forearm flexion, because it has other actions as well. The insertion is both the radius and the ulna. The radius, the tubercle on the radius, and then there are tendinous sheaths around the ulna right here, which is the other insertion for the biceps brachii. Okay, now in this particular example, all right, we see that the insertion is the inferior attachment point and the origin is the superior one. So that's different than the sternocleidomastoid and rectus abdominis, and this is the typical arrangement that you see in appendages. Origin will be superior and the insertion will be inferior. All right, but trunk muscles, it kind of flips the other way. Okay. All right, well, to just kind of reinforce that concept of antagonism, the muscle that's antagonistic to the biceps brachii is the, not biceps femoris, but the triceps brachii. And again, that's going to be in the arm, but posterior arm. You've got a long head, you've got a lateral head, and a medial head. And this kind of matches up nicely with the biceps. The long head origin is the infraglenoid tubercle. Can you picture where that is? That's right below the glenoid fossa on the scapula, kind of right across the glenoid fossa from the supraglenoid tubercle. The lateral head, right, on the shaft of the humerus, right, and the proximal posterior part of the humerus, and the medial head is going to be on the distal posterior shaft. So that's the shortest one. The medial head is the shortest one, and the deepest one, that might be the hardest one to see. But the insertion is going to be on a big strong bone in your forearm, big strong, actually it's a part of a bone, and that's the olecranon process. All right, so that's going to cause extension. So I'm not sure if I have a picture of this is a pretty good picture of the triceps. We see two heads of the triceps, so we're looking at the posterior arm. All right, so here is the long head that goes to the infraglenoid tubercle. Okay, here is the lateral head, which is at which the origin is the proximal part of the humerus, and then the deep part, which we can't see over here, the origin is what the distal shaft of the humerus. So it's about where the cursor is. And all three of those muscle bellies have a common insertion on this common tendon right here, which inserts into the olecranon process of the ulna, causing extension across the elbow. And of course, this one you can see part of that muscle also goes across the shoulder, so it can help adduct the arm as well. Okay, so those are a good way to get started knowing some muscles. We got a couple more. One more. Gastrocnemius. We didn't talk about this one in lab. Okay, but this is going to help you understand dorsiflexion and plantar flexion. So we're going to look for muscles in the leg. Where's a good one for leg? Probably right here. I don't know if I have another one. All right, so here's your knee. Behind your knee is what we call the popliteal region. So just inferior to that popliteal region, we have the gastrocnemius. And you can see there are two heads to the gastrocnemius. And the origin is superior, the insertion is inferior. And these origins are on the femur, right? On the supracondylar ridges of the femur. And both of these muscles then insert into a common tendon that we call tendon of the gastrocnemius, but it also goes by two other names, right? Sometimes we call it the calcaneal tendon because it inserts into the calcaneus, and we also call that the Achilles tendon, right, from Greek mythology. Either one would be acceptable. All right, so when the gastrocnemius contracts, it's going to pull the calcaneus up superiorly, and the calcaneus is posterior to the malleoli right here, so it's going to pull the heel up, and it's going to force your toes in what direction? Down, right, because these malleoli right here is kind of like the pivot point within the ankle. So as the calcaneus moves superiorly, the anterior parts of your feet move inferiorly, or we call that plantar flexion. So gastrocnemius is an important muscle for plantar flexing. There's another muscle in that compartment, and we see it right here. It's deep to the gastrocnemius, and we call it the soleus. It's not labeled on this diagram right here, but I could give you a good pop quiz at the moment and say that it's in the same compartment as the gastrocnemius. So what is the action of the soleus going to be if it's in the same compartment, same body compartment? You're thinking, they're sort of saying, it's going to be, they're going to be synergists, right, if they're in the same body compartment. So the action of the soleus right here is also plantar flexion. And if we want to look for dorsiflexors, what do we have to do? We got to drag this item and kind of twirl it around and look for muscles in the anterior leg, which we can't really see very well on this diagram. Okay, so those are really good muscles for you to become familiar with. All right, so today we were to look at muscles of the head and trunk and some of the arm. We've looked at most of these muscles in lab already. All right, so we can see some strap muscles like the sternocleidomastoid, some orbicularis muscles like the oculi and oris around the mouth. And basically when you study these muscles, maybe you should try to break them down into two categories, muscles of mastication and muscles of facial expression. That's probably the best way to do it. So if we were to say masseter, what would that be? What group would that fall into? Mastication. Temporalis, mastication as well. That's where elevating the mandible. And what about the zygomaticus muscles? The zygomatics, minor and major, that's for facial expression, right? That would be a smiling muscle. All right, and orbicularis oris right here. That's kind of a toss-up if that's for facial expression or mastication. That's important for mastication because your mom always told you to do what? Chew with your mouth closed, right? Exercise those orbicularis oris muscles. But that's also a puckering muscle, right, which could be thought of as communication. So I don't know which one it falls into more. The depressor anguli oris. So the action of that muscle is in the name, right? And the insertion is in the name right here. Anguli, it's toward the angle of the mouth, and that will depress the angle of the mouth, and oris is the oral region right here. So that's what, a frowning muscle, a pouting muscle. Depressor labii inferioris. There's a lot of nice information in that name. The action is it depresses something. What does it depress? A labium, and a labium is a lip right here. And which one does it depress? Not the upper lip, but the lower lip, right? Inferioris. Okay. One thing that's not so obvious, and maybe we took it out of your lab list, there is something called a palpebra, right? And a palpebra looks a lot like a labii, but it's not. A palpebra is an eyelid. When we get to senses, we'll talk about that one. There is a levator palpebrae superioris. All right, so it has to do with an eyelid, levator superioris. Which eyelid is it going to work on? The upper eyelid, right? And it's going to what? Elevate the upper eyelid. So just by knowing nomenclature, it alleviates the necessity to memorize a bunch of muscles. Okay, in lab we learned, okay, that the sternocleidomastoids flex the neck, and there should be antagonistic muscles that are in the opposite body compartment over here, and that would be the splenius capitis that extends the neck. So I'm really kind of beating that concept up. If you want to find antagonistic muscles, you have to go to the opposite body compartment. Okay, so sorry for mentioning that over and over and over again. But I'm a little concerned with you guys, because on the practicum, a lot of people couldn't tell the difference between a foot and a hand, and a male and female pelvis. So, huh? Yeah, it was a female. I think I had the female pelvis out for every test. Maybe I switched it for one, but anyway, I think it was a female pelvis. Okay. So, anyway, so let's continue on a little bit. Let's look at some muscles that work across, some breathing muscles. Okay, breathing muscles. One of the most important muscles for inspiration is the diaphragm. Okay, here we have the diaphragm. This is kind of a weird view. We're looking up underneath the diaphragm, looking up into it. But if we have a frontal view of the diaphragm, it's going to look like a dome, like how I have my fingers positioned, my hands positioned right here. Okay, and when a muscle contracts, okay, what proteins inside of a muscle actually shorten? So when the diaphragm contracts, okay, what proteins inside those muscles actually shorten? You're shaking your head back and forth like that. Like I'm trying to trick you or something. Okay, and indeed I am, because there are no proteins that shorten. What happens to proteins within a muscle? Like the, and what are the names of the two most important for muscle contraction? Actin and myosin. And how do you describe their action when a muscle contracts? They slide, right? They slide. So interdigitate your fingers and watch what happens to the dome shape of the diaphragm when it contracts. Right? It flattens out when it contracts. And when it relaxes, the filaments slide back over each other, and it goes back to that dome shape because there's elasticity in all muscles. So that's going to bring that muscle back to its resting location. Well, when the filaments slide past each other for contraction and the diaphragm flattens out, what happens to the volume of your thoracic cavity? Let's put the diaphragm relaxed where it belongs. Let's contract it, and the diaphragm contracts. What happens to the volume of my thoracic cavity? It increases, and as the volume increases, what happens to air in my airways? It goes in. So the contraction of the diaphragm is the most important muscle for inspiration. Air going in is what we call inspiration. And then when you relax, the muscle goes back because of the elastic properties, and you exhale. Okay, so diaphragm is very important for inspiration, and the elasticity in it also helps you for expiration during quiet breathing, like the kind of breathing right now. You hardly use any muscles at all to exhale because your lungs are so elastic and the diaphragm is very elastic. Okay, so that's one important muscle for inspiration. We also have some muscles between the ribs, and we call those intercostal muscles, right? And because you could think of a rib, right? Whenever you hear the term costal, you should think of rib. There are muscles that pull the rib cage up. All these muscles are indirectly attached to ribs number 1 and 2. And remember from lab that the scalene muscles are attached to 1 and 2. The scalene muscles will elevate the ribs. The external intercostals are attached to ribs 1 and 2, and these will elevate the rib cage. And as the rib cage elevates, does the volume of the thoracic cavity go up or down? It goes up, air flows in. Right? So you inhale when the diaphragm goes down and these intercostal pulls the rib cage up along with those scalene muscles. Right? So externals are for inspiration. And then if we look on the inside of the thoracic cage, we see different muscles. These are the internal intercostals. They're right between the ribs as well, but they're deeper. This is the deep set. These will pull the rib cage down, right? The externals pull it up, the internals pull it down. And what happens to your breathing, or what is actually going on in breathing when the internal intercostals contract? When they contract, your rib cage moves down. That's like squeezing on a balloon. If you're squeezing on a balloon, is air going to go in or out? It's going to go out, right? So when the internal intercostals contract, that is an aid for expiration. Those are muscles for expiration. Okay, there are a couple other muscles for expiration, and those are right here. Okay, the abdominal muscles. Not when you're breathing quietly like you are right now, but when you're exercising or hyperventilating. All of these muscles right here, the rectus abdominis, external oblique, internal oblique, and transverse abdominis right here, will compress all the contents, all the organs in the abdominal and pelvic cavity, but mostly abdominal cavity. Right? And when it compresses them, they have a tendency to move superiorly. Right? So they're going to move up, they're going to push up on the diaphragm even more. And what does that do for your breathing? That's going to aid expiration, right? So using abdominal muscles is a way to aid expiration. And I'm sure singers, right, really work these muscles a lot when they're singing because that's, are you inhaling or exhaling when you're singing? You're exhaling, right? I don't know anybody that can sing while they're inspiring, but that would be pretty cool. Somebody should think about doing that. Okay, so all of these abdominal muscles are muscles for expiration. So they're used for breathing in and out. Okay. Okay. We talked about flexion and extension of the neck, namely flexion the sternocleidomastoids and extension the splenius muscles. And let's go back down to this one right here. Also, when the rectus abdominis contracts and even the other abdominal muscles, right, so this is an anterior muscle, there is an anterior muscle that causes flexion of the neck. Which one is that? Flexion of the neck is the sternocleidomastoid. That's an anterior compartment. The abdominal muscles are in an anterior compartment. Do you think those flex or extend the rest of the vertebral column? That's flexion. Right, so the rectus abdominis is important for flexing the rest of the vertebral column. And the extensors, where would you look for extensors of the vertebral column? Yeah, the posterior trunk, right? And we're going to find thousands of muscles in the posterior trunk. Fortunately, you only have to know the name of one of them, right? Because I want you to understand antagonism more than the names of all these different muscles. So these muscles right here are antagonistic to the rectus abdominis. These will extend the vertebral column. And the one that I want you to know is called the erector spinae. So if somebody points to any of these muscles right here, you're going to say erector spinae. But you should know that these are, what, extensors of the vertebral column and antagonistic to the rectus abdominis. All right, so just simplify your studying right here. All of these are just, we're going to call erector spinae muscles. Okay. All right, let's talk now probably about some muscles that go across the shoulder. Well, here's a nice picture that shows, all right, the external, the internal, transverse abdominis. This is superficial. Here's a second most deepest, and then the deepest is the transverse abdominis right here of the abdominal muscles. Muscles that work across the shoulder. We talked about the triceps and biceps already, but there are some additional muscles that go from the scapula over to various tubercles on the head of the humerus. And we've got a number of them. So here is one in the supraspinous fossa. Here is one in the infraspinous fossa. So the first one we call the supraspinatus. So this one down here is the infraspinatus. These go across the shoulder joint. Most of these are for lateral rotation. Right, so the humerus, you can rotate because it's a pretty fancy ball and socket joint. Maybe a better way to watch that rotation is to what, flex at the elbow and then move your forearm medial and laterally. So in order for your forearm to move like that, your radius is what? Rotating. All right, so these are the muscles that perform that kind of motion. The teres minor, the infraspinatus and supraspinatus. And then there's another one that's on the anterior side of the scapula. What's that fossa on the anterior side of the scapula called? Yeah, subscapular fossa. There's a muscle in there called the subscapularis. Well, not only are these muscles that go across the shoulder joint, but they're the tendons of those muscles actually help form the fibrous capsule of the shoulder. It also forms the joint capsule. So they're not only muscles, but it helps form the joint capsule. So when there's an injury to one of these muscles or one of the tendons or more than one of these tendons right here, not only does it disrupt the activity of these muscles right here, but it disrupts the integrity of the shoulder joint, the capsule of the shoulder, right? And it can be very, very painful. And you see that the insertion is for the infraspinatus and the teres minor is on the posterior part of the humerus, so it's going to pull the posterior part of the humerus toward midline. What's going to happen to your humerus when the posterior part is pulled toward midline? It's going to produce a lateral rotation, right? If it's attached to the anterior part, it's going to produce a medial rotation, but you see most of the muscles here produce a lateral rotation. And when these muscles become injured, we call that a rotator cuff tear. Right, because these muscles are important for rotating the humerus. And you got to know what muscles make up the rotator cuff muscles. So let's see if we can write that down. Rotator cuff muscles. We've got the subscapularis. That's one. All right, that's in the subscapular fossa. And then we've got the infraspinatus. That's another one. And then we've got the teres muscle. Okay. And this is going to be the hardest thing for you to remember. Which one is it? Teres minor. Let's look at that one. Well, if there's a teres minor, that means that there is a teres major. Okay, the teres major doesn't go to the shoulder joint, it just goes to the diaphysis of the humerus. That's kind of an important adductor of the arm, not so much a rotator. But here is the teres minor that actually goes up toward the shoulder joint, right? So the rotator cuff includes the teres minor, but not the teres major. Rotator cuff, teres minor, but not teres major. All right, and then there's one more. Okay, and that is the supraspinatus. Muscle. All right, so those four muscles make up the rotator cuff. And how can you sort of remember this? There's a little trick. to remembering those four muscles, at least part of them. Yeah, sits. Right? So just say sits, S-I-T-S, and just try to associate that with those various muscles right there. Okay, and the reason why that really affects the shoulder joint is because these tendons right here actually make up the joint capsule. So any damage to these tendons also damages the joint capsule as well. Let's see, some forearm muscles. In lab, you have some really nice models, a lot better than these pictures right here. Okay, but we're looking at flexor muscles. Look, flexor carpi ulnaris, flexor carpi radialis, flexor digitorum muscles. So you should be able to tell me what body compartment we're looking at. Is this a posterior view or an anterior view? Okay, because all the flexors are in the anterior arm. All right, so even though it probably doesn't tell you, I don't see a legend to this figure, you know that this is the anterior forearm, and this arm is in anatomic position, right? Because the thumb is kind of pointing laterally right there. All right, so we have muscles that go to the digits. Those are going to be digitorum muscles, and we've got a couple of them. We've got one really tiny weak one right here that we call the palmaris longus because the insertion is just to some connective tissue in the palm of the hand. It's not a terribly important muscle in humans. It's more important in other kinds of animals that have extended ankles like horses and things like that. But it's a beautiful tendon nonetheless. And if you ever need a tendon in another part of your body, this is an excellent place to go find a tendon that is beautiful and that you really don't need anyway. So if this needs to be used to reinforce a joint, it can be harvested and placed in another joint. That's the palmaris longus. These other ones that go to the digits right here, that's what we just call the flexor digitorum. That's deep to the palmaris longus, and you can see tendons moving up into the digits. And then we have some that just insert into various carpal bones. So those are going to be what? The flexor carpi muscles. And here's one that is lateral, right? So that's the flexor carpi radialis, and then here's one that's medial, that's the flexor carpi ulnaris, right? Because the ulna is medial. And you have the same arrangement of muscles in the posterior arm, all right? So what would you expect? An extensor digitorum, right? An extensor carpi ulnaris and an extensor carpi radialis. And you can tell, right, where the radius is by knowing something about this thumb right here. Okay. Well, there's only two other muscles that I think you should be interested in the forearm, and that is the biggest one and one of the smallest ones. The brachioradialis goes across the elbow, right? And then there's one that's right here called the pronator teres. And when you go to shake somebody's hand with your thumb pointing up, all right, those are the muscles that you're going to run into if you look right down on the top of your arm, right? This big one, right, that's maybe just posterior to your thumb, that's the brachioradialis. And this other one right here, that's the pronator teres. And these two muscles come together to form a letter of the alphabet. This is a really nice, easy landmark for me to see when I'm looking at models in lab or even when I'm looking at people, right? What letter does this look like? Yeah, if it's right side up, it kind of looks like an A without the bottom right here. All right, but I look at it, I see a B. Okay, you can see an A, but I see a B right there, and the two parts of the B are this little pronator teres, and then this big part right here is the brachioradialis. That's the strongest one in your forearm. All right, so pronator teres and brachioradialis don't fit nicely in the scheme of what? The flexor digitorum, the flexor carpi muscle, so that's like some independent knowledge that you have to have. And where do you start to look at that? Like do a handshake, and right there is that B, brachioradialis, pronator teres. And of course, the pronator teres does what? It pronates the forearm. It makes the palm of your hand when it contracts face posteriorly, pronation. All right, then there's a muscle that you don't have to know in here. So if you have a muscle that pronates, guess what else you have? You have a supinator as well, but there's only so much that we can cover. All right, so pronator teres, I do want you to know something about. Okay, so that I think is most, that's the muscles that I want to talk about in lecture. There's some superficial muscles, all right? Like if we look at the posterior compartment, like latissimus dorsi, trapezius, we're going to talk about those. Pectoralis major, we'll talk about those in lab. Okay. So that's pretty much it for lecture today. Who's got the sign-in sheet? Oh, you know, how about if I show you some good web resources? Before we go. Dang, I forgot about that. Okay. The website is called Get Body Smart. I maybe had this activated in other modules. This is going to be in, it's not the week we're in right now. It's week number 7, I think. Week number 8. All right, so I'll activate this one before the test. But remember, this is not on the test on Monday. But if you want to start looking around and being prepared, all right, here are a bunch of labeling exercises that are really nice. But this website is really nice. Okay, this is getbodysmart.com. Okay, and what I like to do, I have a program to open up in a new window, but it doesn't always work. So if you right-click and open in a new window or new tab, right, that's, then you're guaranteed that it's going to work properly. All right, so what muscles have we talked about? Teres minor, right here. Where is that teres minor at? Okay, that's in the, it's going to go from the scapula over to the humerus. So here is the teres major. Oh, and teres minor is way up over here someplace. It's deep, we can't find it. So how are we going to find it? Let's get rid of some of these other muscles. All right, so here is teres minor. Look, you can see it in nice isolation with each other. All right, over here you can find the origin and insertion. So if I click, all right, it's going to highlight the origin and the insertion. All right, and what is its action? It's going to pull this part of the humerus toward midline. It's going to cause a rotation, lateral rotation. All right, so here is another mannequin that you can actually have him perform a lateral rotation on. All right, so you can look at origin, insertion, where that muscle is, have that motion produced right before your very eyes. And then if you want to rebuild the shoulder joint, just start putting a bunch of these muscles back, like what? The medial head of the triceps, right? Lateral head of the triceps, long head of the triceps. So that's really, really handy to do that. Latissimus dorsi. You can rebuild the shoulder joint and look at all those muscles. You can turn the labels off, practice labeling, right? And then you can check yourself right here. You don't need any passwords to get to this website. And if that window looks a little small, I kind of shrunk it down, you can always do, this work has worked before. If I want to make this content on this webpage bigger, what do I do? Control plus. Aha, it's not working. It works with 7. Why is it not working here? Oh, it's, I don't know. Maybe I didn't type it right. Control plus. To shrink it down, control minus. Okay, control plus. That will work with things that are kind of defined as text in HTML. So if you really want to zoom into this area right here, right, you can. And here is what? A nice lateral rotation. Okay, so I just wanted to show that to you. So that's it for today. Hey, Tyler. Hey, when you got lab? You got lab today? Okay, good. See you upstairs. Okay. Hi, Shel. Yeah.
Today, I won't be able to make it to the whole lab just for the quiz, and then I would have to leave.
Yeah?
Just letting you know, I don't want it to be a surprise.
Okay. Oh, okay. It's yeah, be sure you take the quiz.
Yeah, yeah.
So you get credit for the quiz, but not attendance.
Okay. How'd you get the notes from someone else?
Sounds good. But you got to practice with those muscles. Go to the study room, or I think the library has some.
Okay.
Because you get too far behind.
Hi.
Hi. This is 231.
Well, that one just taught?
Yeah, 231, anatomy. And then there's another class coming in after this one.
Well, I'm looking for bio 160.
Yeah, it might be in this room after, at noon. It might be here at noon, maybe.
Thanks.
Yeah, welcome. You know, there's still a lot of students that want to add classes.
Really?
And I think that's because every junior college has such a different schedule that there must be some colleges that are starting up this week. It's really weird. Really weird.
Midterms,
yeah, just... Yeah, Austin.
On chapter 6?
Yeah?
For the study guide, you think they're going over the... Going over most of it, the fetus, the discussion of the fetus? Are you going to kind of...
Circulation, I do. But not for chapter 6, I don't think. What do you... I'm baffled. I can't imagine.
Part of the chapter 6, but...
There was a neonate skull. You had to know fontanelles.
For the fetus.
Yeah, you have to know fontanelles. That's the only thing I can imagine that you need. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think you need to know anything else about a fetus. At least right now. Circulation a little bit later.
The sign sheet.
Yeah, where's that sign-in sheet at?
I was here on Monday.
Okay. Well, I can only offer you my congratulations for being here. But you have a blue line through you? So,
right here.
Yeah, you used up attendance. You don't get credit for that blue line. You got to sign that sheet because, man, I can't remember if you were here on Monday or not. I have no chance of remembering. That's why you got to sign in every time. And you don't get points for attendance, but if you miss more than a week, then I could drop you.
So G's done.
Are you close? Yeah. Yeah. Are you missing a lot?
No, I haven't missed any.
You haven't missed any? Well, then that's not a problem. It's only if you start missing a lot.
Oh, okay.
Did you sign in?
Yeah.
Did you sign in today? Everybody sign in today?
And I signed for Monday.
Yeah. Okay. But you got the blue line already, right there. Okay. So it's really important because when you sign it, that's your receipt that you're in class. Okay. Okay. So it's no big deal unless it's a habit.
Is there any graph that you wanted to know? Is that just bones and stuff? Because I know we did lab, but I mean, I don't want to overstudy something that I already studied and put my...
Okay, so are you interested in for practicum or for a lecture test or for a quiz?
For the lecture.
Oh, let me turn this microphone.